about the last time you latched on to something, confident that it would, or perhaps would not, happen, even when all of the evidence and logic supported another outcome. Most of us do it all the time. Many Atlanta sports fans were absolutely confident that the United were going to disappoint us in the championship game. It's why people run out of gas on the highway. We do it on more meaningful things too. Expecting a situation to work out or a person to change when any outside observer can see how unlikely it is. I've seen kids attempt physical feats that it was simply impossible to accomplish. I've seen adults under the mantra of, I'll figure it out somehow, make commitments to tasks and timelines that can never be kept. And in all of these cases, no matter how big or small, we're surprised and often disappointed when things didn't turn out how we just knew they would, despite the fact that we had no reason to believe they would at all. Whether it's to try to get what we want, to avoid accepting what we don't want, or to impress others, it's not uncommon that we voluntarily exchange the truth for a lie. In the realm of sports, it's funny. In the realm of work, it's risky. In terms of relationships, it's harmful. And in the realm of theology, it's death. And that's no exaggeration. The cost of this truth exchange is so severe that in Paul's discussion here, he begins not by describing the truth that is rejected or by describing the people who reject such truth, but he starts with the outcome of making this truth exchange, the wrath of God revealed from heaven. This is the other side of the gospel coin. Paul, having introduced the positive aspects of the faith for those who put their trust in Jesus Christ, now turns to the outcome for those who do not. Received by grace through faith unto obedience and life, or reject God, deny his claims, call him a liar, and remain an object of his wrath. It's a hard thing to talk about, but Paul has already told us he's not ashamed of the gospel. And so here he proves his point. It's easy to tell the world that God loves them just like they are and they need to change nothing. And God is happy or satisfied with whatever way they want to acknowledge him. But it's something much more difficult and therefore easier for us to avoid when we have to tell the world that God's wrath is, even now, being poured out against those who reject him by ungodliness and unrighteousness. Notice, though, how God first defines ungodliness and unrighteousness. You know, Christians are rather disliked by the world these days. That's no secret. And that would be good and as expected if we were disliked for the right reasons. Much of what Christianity says publicly to the culture, what we say to the world, is that non-Christians would be better off if they just acted more like Christians. We focus much of our attention and lecturing on behavior rather than belief. But look at what Paul does here. The form this ungodliness and unrighteousness takes begins by suppression of the truth. Verse 21, though God is obvious to all, they exchange what they know for a lie. They deny what can be known about him. They do not honor him and they do not give thanks to him. Paul's not minimizing sins like coveting or giving in to sexual temptation or living entirely for self. He's just putting first things first. Where do these sins that lead to destruction begin? Where does a life first go off the rails? By exchanging the glory of the immortal God for lies. By elevating created things to a position of greater value and glory than the God who made them. Is your wealth more important than God? You've exchanged the truth for a lie. Popularity, what others think of you. Likewise. Is your family more important than God? You've exchanged the truth for a lie. How about just getting to do what you want to do. Getting to do what you want to do and live how you want to live. Is that more important than God? Life on your own terms. If it is, you've exchanged the truth for a lie. Everything else in a human life flows from this choice. It's the seed of unrighteousness from which all ungodliness and all immorality flows. The early churchman Origen, in his commentary on Romans, points out that ungodliness refers to sin against God and unrighteousness to sin against human beings. And so those who reject the truth, who suppress the truth of God, sin against both God and humanity. Those who say there is no God have sinned against Him by denying His existence and His authority over them. But it also drives them to deny the responsibility found in God's command to love thy neighbor. And it all started with a lie. Now, why do people make this choice? Well, because they want to. Make no mistake. Paul says there are no victims here. They chose, verse 18, to suppress the truth. What can be known about God, verse 19, is plain to them. God has shown it to them. His attributes have been clearly perceived in the things He's made, verse 20, since the beginning of the world. They know God, verse 21. So why do people make such a choice? It's because they want to. There is no excuse. Paul's argument reveals that if the gospel interferes with free will, it's not because God is up there forcing men to reject Him. It's not because He hides His face or He hides the truth from humanity. He didn't reveal Himself in secret and hidden ways that are only revealed to a select few. He's out there for the world to see in everything He's ever made. By creating every single man and woman in His image, by putting them in the world which He created and sustains, He provides every single person with ample evidence to believe. There is no one who wants to believe in God, no one who seeks God, no one who wishes they could have faith who God rejects. Those who reject God choose this path for themselves. And why do they choose this path? Why do they make this choice? Because they want to. Paul doesn't believe God interferes with free will as it actually exists at all. But even if He did, he shows here that the only accusation we could make is that God interferes with the free will of those who hate Him when He takes some of them and, despite their hatred, makes Himself so irresistibly appealing that they can do nothing but turn to Him in love. Seems a bit silly to accuse God of violating free will for that. It doesn't violate someone's conscience for God to let people who want to reject Him continue to reject Him. And so the only real violation of free will in this scenario is if we demand that God makes Himself irresistibly appealing to everyone who rejects Him. And so the only free will being violated is God's. I want to believe, but God won't let me, is not a statement ever uttered honestly. I'm seeking after God, but He's hidden Himself from me forever. Likewise, we may feel that way at times, but know this, it's simply untrue. If you desire God, if you desire to be known by Him and to know Him, you already do. It's just a question of asking God more directly to help give you more light, more understanding, because God is out there to be seen. Verse 19 says He can be seen plainly. Verse 20 says He's been perceived successfully by all. Verse 21 says everyone knows God. But many choose, despite all of that, not to honor Him as God and not to give thanks to Him. It's the truth exchange, and many will make it. Sometimes I think even we Christians are brainwashed a bit by the world's anti-religion. Sometimes I think we can buy into this claim that God has made it really difficult to know Him, and that if God really wanted Himself to be known by people, He would have done something more direct, more vivid, more obvious. Paul points out it's not hard to figure out that God exists as both creator and sustainer. After all, the earth is here. It's formed and it's filled with all sorts of living creatures, including man himself. And for everything that exists in this world, there also exists everything which it needs to survive and to thrive. The stars are in the heavens in their majesty, but there's only one star that's close enough to this planet to keep things within a livable range of temperatures. And every morning, that star rises and our hearts continue to beat. All kinds of what we call natural events take place each day to remind us that God is sustaining the earth and reveal how carefully and how perfectly He's made it. It's obvious to anyone who isn't already committed to rejecting it that God is. And that's why the proper emotion for us to have toward those who've made the truth exchange isn't anger or haughtiness, but pity. Claiming to be wise, those who made the exchange have become instead fools. We should pity them. We should pray for them. We should desire to help them. No one wants to remain a fool. Jake mentioned in his prayer, I was thinking about Hawking and these lines of brilliant scientists, and I think of Richard Dawkins, a man considered by many to be the most brilliant man on the planet, the smartest person alive. And on many points, he does possess great knowledge. But the same man who I've heard state emphatically, time and time again, that the existence of God is impossible and should not be considered by any right-thinking person, that same man suggests that life on this planet could have begun when it was brought here by aliens from another planet. Some questions in life, like, where did all of this come from, have such obvious answers, like, they came from the one who made them, that those who reject those answers are left with nothing but laughable nonsense. Claiming to be wise, they have become fools. Now, you'd be ridiculed for suggesting it publicly, and I have. But the claims of macroevolution are as laughable as Dawkins' "we're all alien babies" suggestion. As the testimony of God and the evidence of this world reveal, all forms of life within our vast similarities and differences were created by God. But because many don't want to acknowledge God as God, they're forced to invent fantastical lies to replace the truth. They're not guided by science, reason, or evidence. They're guided by a theological conviction. I will not acknowledge God as God. I will not give thanks to Him. And so from that starting point, it takes us from ideas like molten lava and primordial ooze to spontaneous cells and fish and birds and monkeys and then you and me. Christianity and science are not incompatible. The theological claim that God does not exist and the theological claim that God does exist are incompatible. And once we've picked our religion, our scientific claims extend explicitly from them as expected. What do we see when we look at nature? Paul makes a bold claim here. What does good faith science reveal? Paul tells us we see the invisible attributes of God. Paul says when we look around this world at everything that's been made, we see God's forming and His filling. We see how everything that exists has everything it needs in this world to continue to exist. We see the earth's rotation, the position of the sun, atmospheric composition, every unique thing about this planet so carefully tuned to support human life. Kids, let's look at something smaller. Let's think about spiders for a moment. Who likes spiders? Nobody likes them. Oh, good. We've got one spider lover. Poisonous spiders have two fangs, so that when they bite something, they can use those fangs to put poison into what they bit. And so those fangs have to be hollow on the inside so they can fill up with poison. But they also have to have these little holes so that when they bite into something, the poison can come out. They've got these little complicated valves that open and shut so that the poison doesn't just dribble out when they're walking around. Oh, and the poison can't be uncontrolled when it's inside of their body either. It's poisonous. What would happen if the spider's poison leaked out inside the spider's body? Blah, dead spider. So they have these special little pouches in their body so that the poisons don't kill the spiders too. Now, what does logic, looking at our spider friend, say? Wow. That gross thing is amazing. That thing was created. It was intricately crafted to do all this work. And what does the truth exchange say? Well, like all life, this spider is the result of small, random genetic mutations taking place over thousands of years. Well, except for the changes related to the poison, each of those had to evolve at exactly the same time because a poison sac isn't genetically necessary without poison or without fangs with which to inject it. So if one of those had evolved first by mutation, it would not have been passed on. It's a tongue twister of foolishness. If you have an interest in science, you might enjoy studying about some of the more complicated features of life in the animal kingdom, some of what's called irreducible complexity. With all of these intricacies and complexities in the things that God has made, He has made the world so that all can look at it and see the testament God makes to Himself. The creation cries out the truth of its Creator. As Psalm 18 says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. You all are hearing me quote John Chrysostom a lot these days, but his description of this is beautiful. How did God reveal Himself, he says? By a voice from heaven? Not at all. Through a panoply. A multitude of things to be seen and heard and smelled and touched, which was able to draw them by more than just a voice. He sets before you an immense creation so that both the wise and the unlearned might ascend to God, having learned through sight the beauty of the things which they have seen. That is exactly what Paul says in verses 19 and 20. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. The evidence is there, Paul says. You can't miss it. It's all around you, and it's been all around you since you were created. There is no excuse for the truth exchange. So why would anyone do it? What prompts a person to deny what is so obviously true for the sake of a lie? Claiming to be wise, Paul says. The attainment of knowledge is a powerful force. It's just as there are holy and unholy pursuits and uses of money, and holy and unholy pursuits and uses of power, so too there are holy and unholy pursuits and uses of knowledge. Knowledge pursued to justify our own behavior, to cast off the shackles of God's lordship, to do what we want and to live how we want, that's unholy knowledge. And so people pursue knowledge in many fields of study, including but not limited to science, and they pursue it not to learn more about the reality that God has made, but to find anything they can use to puff up themselves, to claim superior understanding over God's revelation, and yes, to throw off any remaining remnant of obligation toward God. You see this in every field. If you study trees apart from the glory of God, you will either come to worship the trees or the man who knows the most about them. If you study economics apart from the glory of God, you will either come to worship it or the woman who knows the most about it. The church father Ambrosiaster says, they imagined that they were wise because they had explored the natural sciences, investigating the courses of the stars and the quantities of the elements. But they rejected the God who made them, and therefore they are fools. For if all these things are worthy of praise, how much more so the God who made them? True study True scholarship, true learning, true knowledge always ends in doxology. Whether you study science and nature or literature or music or art, true study always ends in doxology. Isn't that what Paul does in verse 25 when he just explodes with the Creator who is blessed forever? Amen. If these things are worthy of praise, how much more is their Creator? In every single study, kids, in every single thing we learn, there is an opportunity to stand back in amazement at what God has made. Sometimes we have to just look at things in this world, whether it's something beautiful like the mountains and the Grand Canyon, or something gross like an intricately designed spider, and we have to say, how awesome is the God who made this? Human and animal biology, plant life, astronomy, math, music, justice, color, sound, beauty. God made them all. And if you want to see God, ask God. He will show you Himself in all of them. No one has ever asked God for eyes to see, and God failed to provide them. But most never ask. In fact, they work actively to blind themselves to the truth about God and what He has made. They have made the truth exchange. And returning to verse 18, therefore God's wrath is being poured out against them. Why must God respond in wrath to their unrighteousness? Can't He just let them be? Because while we think of this as simply an individual person's bad decision, what the truth exchange actually is an indictment on truth itself. Ask the question another way. Can the truth be exchanged for a lie and God be satisfied? No. If God is truth, He must vindicate the truth in order to vindicate Himself. The truth exchange requires a response. And while God will vindicate Himself and vindicate the truth on the day of judgment, look carefully because Paul actually speaks here in the present tense. The wrath of God is being revealed now, here, at this time. Paul says the wrath of God is being revealed. And he describes two ways in which that is true. The first stems from the real-time consequences of worshiping the creature rather than the Creator. Notice the word that he adds in verse 25. He adds the word served. They don't just worship the creation, they serve it. And that's no way to live, because in God's judgment, our service of the creation becomes slavery. A life serving God, making joyful use of the creation, is the abundant life Jesus offers in John 10. Anxiety, strife, hardship, toll, these are reduced because we worship and serve God. It prevents me from becoming a slave to my work, a slave to my biological urges, a slave to my felt needs, a slave to social movements and pressure, anything else that I put in the place of God that would then turn the tables on me and control my life, making me its slave. The abundant life in Christ prevents that slavery. And those who've exchanged the truth are slaves to things that do not love them and do not care for them and do not want good for them. God in His wrath against them does not intervene, allowing them to live as slaves of the choices they've made. Again, this is why our response should be pity and not haughtiness. There but for the grace of God go I. I would be a slave to every one of those things. Except that God intervened. The second way, though, stems from the earthly consequences of the sins we've chosen. When we live unconcerned for the honor and purity of the God who made us, we're given up to our own impure lusts. Our hearts get what they want in rejection of the truth, and what we want both dishonors and harms us. Many sins have human, earthly consequences. Addictions destroy health and relationships. Theft prevents work, prosperity, and good reputation. And with the language that he uses here, Paul identifies one category of sin specifically as an example of what happens when people reject God's obvious truth and give them over to their foolishness. And he's talking about the sins which stem from rejecting how God made physical gender and sexuality. And if you're following this passage carefully, it's the most reasonable example to give. It's not that these sins are more heinous or more common or more gross than any other human sin. Struggling with same-sex attraction, struggling with God's calling and responsibilities based on our gender are not so unlike any other sin in our lives. Paul uses this example not because it's weird or particularly condemned, but because it fits the point he's making about what's obvious from creation. God made our bodies and our natures. He made us distinctly male and female from the same initial types of cells, from the same early human development. He called for a biological division, a fork in the road. And on one side is man, made with certain parts unique to human beings and certain parts unique to male human beings. And he made man with certain callings, certain categorical strengths and weaknesses. And on the other side of the fork is woman, the same in humanity, the same in dignity and worth, equally made in his image, with some of the same parts as man, yet with some parts unique, distinct to female humans, some callings, strengths, and weaknesses likewise. Now, I'll be vague and discreet here, but let me say it this way. I've done a fair amount of premarital counseling in my career. And individuals come in with different histories, different pasts, sinful and otherwise, different awarenesses and expectations and experience regarding the marriage bed. But in none of those situations have I ever had to explain the most basic facts of the situation. Adam and Eve did not need an instruction manual for the other's body. Why? Because God made their bodies to fit. Because he showed clearly in nature what his intention is and what is godly and righteous with regards to sexuality. He made it in a way that it's wise, that it works, that it provides security through satisfaction and pleasure, and that it allows the possibility of procreation. He made all these big neon signs that say this is the way it works. And he shows us clearly what is ungodly and unrighteous in the area of sexuality by thwarting all three of the above signs. This, anywhere except within the marriage of one man and one woman, is dangerous, unprosperous, and in varying degrees, to Paul's point here, foolishly unnatural. The evidence makes that rather obvious. And so this is what Paul describes as impurity and the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. And notice that these recipients of God's wrath can make no case against God's justice here, for he has only given them up in the lusts of their own hearts. Having rejected what God makes obviously true in the creation, they have replaced it with an obviously, transparently foolish lie. They're doing exactly what they want to do. And though he's made what's right and true and good visible to them, they choose to reject it just as surely as they've chosen to reject him. They have made the truth exchange. And we must be careful, because the truth exchange is always out there, asking us to buy in as well. That God you believe in is so demanding, it says, so controlling, doesn't let you do what you want to do, doesn't let you do what you know works best for you. You can do better than live under these demands. I use that example because it comes so regularly to me. And when I look at someone who's made the truth exchange, either for the alluring lies of science worship and naturalism, or for the self-fulfilling lies of indiscriminate sexual pleasure or addiction, it's easy for me to become haughty and say I would never make such an exchange. But with just a tweak of the words, and without the grace of God, I surely would. You can do better. The lie says, you can be in control, the lie tempts. And Paul says, it's simply untrue. You know the truth about God. It's clear to you in the world that He's made. And for you, Christians gathered to worship this morning, you have this truth written on your very hearts. He has shown His divine light on your understanding so that you could take what so many reject and know it to be true. For that, let us honor Him and give Him thanks. For that, we can honor Him and give Him thanks. This is what's true. And this is what's real. God has shown Himself to us. And we are without excuse. Thanks be to God.